Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. On December 1st, 2016, Bill Atkinson was placed on A1 status, giving him the highest priority for receiving a new heart. 10 days later, on December 11th at 3:17 p.m., 30-year-old Anchorage resident Jonathan Gilbert was pronounced brain dead after suffering a gunshot wound to the head. Later that night, Mr. Atkinson underwent a successful heart transplant surgery. Jonathan's death and his family's loss meant that Bill and his family would be given the ultimate gift, the gift of life. Please join me and my special guest, heart transplant patient Bill Atkinson, as we spend the next hour talking about organ donation, this time from the recipient's perspective. I want to thank you, Bill, for taking the time to join us here today on Line One. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it as well.
All right. I need to take a second to remind those listening how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or call us toll-free from anywhere in Alaska or anywhere in the country for that matter at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Got to remember to spell out L-I-N-E-O-N-E. That's line one. Please don't hesitate to call us if you have a question for Bill or have a comment or a story about organ donation from your own perspective. It always adds flavor to the show when we get calls. And remember, don't wait until the end of the show because we're always running out of time and we can get you on earlier. The earlier, the better. All right, today's show is a follow-up on a show I did in December about organ donation. On that show, we focused a lot on the organ donation program and heard the story of Jonathan Gilbert and his death. His mother joined us on that show, and so we got to kind of hear the perspective from, you know, the family and their loss and what it meant to them that Jonathan was an organ donor. And today we get kind of a unique opportunity to hear the story from Bill's perspective as the man who received Jonathan's heart that same evening. I think it's kind of timely because yesterday was Jonathan's birthday and today is his wife's birthday. So I hope you'll stay with us for the next hour as Bill talks about his experience over the last few months. All right, Bill, let's, I guess, get right into it by letting our listeners know a little bit about yourself, your life, your family, what you do. Who are you?
Well, I grew up in Washington and Seattle as the last of nine kids. So it's always been pretty hectic around my house.
I
don't have my own kids, but I host exchange students. I've had seven from around the world. I worked in the boating industry for 28 years until I had to retire on a medical disability. I pretty much like my home and boating and collecting old cars.
Well, that doesn't sound too bad. All right. Well, can you talk to us a little bit about your heart condition? What led up to you getting put on the transplant list, and what that process was like a little bit?
Sure. I was working in San Francisco about 14 years ago, and I had an awful lot of fatigue. And then one day I thought I had something in my eye, so I went to the eye doctor, and they took my blood pressure, and it was 212 over 200, which sent me into a cardiologist and checking in the hospital because they couldn't get it to go down. And I finally went through the heart transplant protocol, which is going through all the testing at California Pacific Medical Center. And they said that I did not qualify for a new heart at that time, but they would be surprised if I went 15 years without getting a heart transplant. And I went 14, so they were pretty much spot on.
They were pretty spot on.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What's it like getting that news? I mean, obviously it's devastating, but what's the conversation with your family?
Well, it's kind of odd to quantify that because I actually think I kind of went in denial. I took the medications, I felt better, and I just kind of assumed in my mind that was probably never going to happen. I was just going to get better. So I just kind of ignored it as much as I could.
Okay, and then what were the things that led to you getting put on that list? I mean, at what point did you get moved up to where you then were able to get on the list for heart transplant?
Well, I'd been, they call it, pretty well compensated, meaning the drugs had been doing their job, but every few months they had to redo the drugs and usually raise them. And the words that my transplant surgeon said is I was slowly sliding down a hill, and then I fell off. And I went to my cardiologist, and he called a cab ambulance and sent me to the University of Washington because I had pneumonia and was just feeling terrible. And in fact, my defibrillator had gone off twice on the night before, didn't even wake me up, and that's like 700 volts. So yeah. I was getting pretty weak and still kind of in denial. And then I checked into the University of Washington after he sent me there, and they had me there for a few days and said that I would need to have a heart pump, which is a left ventricular assistance device, installed. So they actually put a pump, they sew it to your heart, and it has batteries you carry in a vest. And a few days later, it actually took a month for them to get me healthy enough for that operation. And a few months or a few days after that, Dr. Mokadam came in, who is the transplant cardiologist, and looked at me in the eye and said, I've got four lousy options for you. He said, I can tune you up as well as I can with medication, send you home, and I give you about a 5% chance of making it to the end of the month. He says, you qualify for palliative care. I can put you in a hospice right now. I can do the heart pump, or I can do the heart pump as a bridge to transplant. And without even thinking about it, I said, I want a transplant. And I think it was the first time that I really came head-to-head with knowing how sick I was.
Yeah, when was that again?
Well, I went into the hospital in early June, and they put I went in early May, and they put me put the heart pump in on June 19th. And then I had to stay for about another month to get strong enough to go home, and then I went home and basically was told it would be probably a year and a half to 2 years to see if I could get a heart.
Okay. Now, what qualifies you to get placed on the transplant list? I'm sure there's all sorts of tests, and they need to make sure that it's, for lack of a better term, worth doing, that you have a reasonable expectation of some recovery and quality of life. So what are the things that qualify you to get put on that list?
Well, there's a number called the ejection fraction, and it's the amount of blood that pumps through your heart with every beat. And the average person is about 65%, and I was at 5%.
Oh.
So I wasn't getting any oxygen, and I wasn't getting blood to my organs, and my kidneys had shut down, and the doctor said that I was actively dying, which was kind of a shock.
Well, yeah, I guess we're all kind of actively dying, but you were maybe doing it a little bit faster than
other folks. A little bit
quicker.
I think I was like Speedy Gonzalez.
Okay, so that was in June or July of this year. And then you mentioned something. You said A1 status in December. So what is, can you maybe explain to listeners what A1 status means? I got a guess, but... what exactly does that mean in the transplant world?
A1 status is the highest priority that can be given to a transplant recipient, meaning their chance of survival without it is very slim. In fact, I was told that from the heart pump installation to a transplant, they gave me about a 40% chance of making it that long. So they were pretty proactive in trying to find a heart for me soon because... You know, I was relatively young. I'm relatively healthy other than the heart. And so I was given the chance to get one, and I jumped at it.
All right. A1 status means essentially that there's not much time left.
Correct.
You're moved way up on the list. Looking at the dates, it was, 10 days. Can you kind of talk about what that time was like? I mean, the doctors say how much time you might have waiting for that heart, or if they thought you were going to make it there?
I think they had mixed feelings, actually. The transplant surgeon, you know, at first gave me the 5%, but the longevity isn't that good or promising with a heart pump, because it just simply blows blood through your heart. There's no beat. There's no rhythm, which you don't even have a pulse or a regular blood pressure. They have to take a blood pressure with an echogram. So they were in a pretty big hurry to get me on the list and get me to A1. And I think I qualified a little faster because I had volunteered to do some clinical research for them, which meant going to the hospital more often, seeing the doctors more often, and just keeping in more contact with them.
Now, what are the, I don't know if you have the percentages or the numbers of people that get put on A1 status, who actually get to the point of getting a transplant done. I mean, how rare is that this happened? Are you familiar with those numbers?
Well, I'm not, but I have been told by the different doctors and cardiologists I meet with. I have a team of 5 cardiologists that I have to visit, but that there's literally thousands of people in the country each year that die waiting for a new organ. And the heart is the hardest organ to transplant because it basically has to be kept alive or it won't start up again, unlike a kidney or a liver. It was pretty gloomy. They were not overly optimistic, and I like that because they weren't just trying to make me feel better. I think they were trying to save my life.
Yeah, so what are the hours like and the nights like and the conversations with your family as you're essentially waiting for, a miracle, I guess is what it is. You're waiting for that to happen. What are those evenings like?
Well, it's a difficult subject for people to talk about.
Yeah.
Because they don't want you to try and remember it. But I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to have things in order. I didn't want to leave them high and dry. So, I mean, I actually got to go home for a little bit where I put my will together, and I even wrote my own eulogy because I didn't want anybody else writing it because they would get it wrong. And so I had all my account numbers written down for my sister, and I was prepared to whatever happened.
Were you saying goodbye to folks? It sounds like you were cleaning up your business end of it. Did you have conversations, the things you wanted to say to people that needed to be said?
Absolutely. I have something like 700 friends on Facebook from all around the world with hosting kids, and they were a wonderful support, but so was everybody else. And I did tell them, I told them, you know, there's a relatively high chance that this will not succeed, so I want you to know how I feel about you.
That must have been, how about for you personally, outside of, it sounds like you're a pretty strong guy and you wanted to have those conversations, but were there times when you were feeling bleak or down or lost hope?
You know, not really. I have to say that I tried to keep a pretty positive attitude. I had a lot of confidence in the people at the University of Washington. I thought they were excellent. And I had good care, and it was denial again. I just didn't want to believe something was going to happen, but I knew it could.
All right. So intellectually, you knew. Emotionally, you were still hanging in there and feeling positive.
Right.
All right. For anybody who might be tuning in late, my guest today is heart recipient Bill Atkinson, who underwent heart transplant surgery on December 11th of 2016, so recently, and he happened to be the recipient of Jonathan Gilbert's heart, who was the subject of a show we did a few weeks back on organ donation. We had Life Center Northwest with us there. I want to remind folks that you can reach us with your questions or comments. If you have a question for Bill or a comment about organ donation or anything to do with that process, please feel free to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, I mentioned Life Center Northwest. That's the organ donation folks that were so great to Jonathan and his family during this whole process, which I got to witness from that side. Did you have much contact with, was those the folks that handled your transplant and all your pre, you know, leading up to this thing?
Actually, the only time that I saw their name was when I received a letter from Jonathan's mother.
Oh, so they had really no contact with you prior from that side?
Well, no, they didn't, and I was told by the hospital staff that people were not usually contacted for up to a year, if at all, and that Mrs. Gilbert had gotten a hold of me faster than anybody could remember any family reaching out to the recipient.
Hmm. All right, so I guess I missed that part of it. So Danita, that's Jonathan's mother. You said she reached out to you shortly thereafter?
Right. Now, it went through the people that you're talking about, so she couldn't use the last name, but she put every detail, and in fact, it was a four-word Google search, and everybody came up. So it was pretty easy to find out in this day and age.
Yeah, computers are amazing. All right, so let's go back just a second. We'll get into some of that in a minute. But what was it like when the docs came in and said, we have a heart for you? What was going through your head? What kind of emotions did you experience? What was that like for you and your family?
Well, I was home, and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning. And the University of Washington called, and I didn't hear the phone. I was sleeping. So I had my crazy neighbor running through my house yelling my name. So I finally got up, and I had about 3 calls on the phone, and I had to call into the University of Washington, and they said that they had a heart. Could I be there, and was I willing to be there within the next 2 hours? And I said yes. So I got dressed, and my sister actually had driven up in the meantime because she couldn't reach me. So she drove me down to the University of Washington, and you check in, and it's a pretty amazing process checking in for a heart transplant. It's a little different than a gallbladder. You're given pretty high priority, and you go into a clean room, and they start with everything. We were there at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and they took me into surgery at 8:30 at night, so there's a lot of time to think about what's going to happen.
Yeah, and what were those thoughts? I mean, are you excited, nervous? Scared?
I'm nervous. To be perfectly honest, I was nervous about having my heart taken out.
Yeah.
And then...
Even though it wasn't working?
Go ahead.
Even though it wasn't working?
Even though it wasn't working, it you know, it's that denial thing again. I just felt all my life like it was going to get better ever since I was diagnosed with a heart problem. And I was still nervous about it, and I was still real trepidatious, and I was not feeling sorry for myself as much as I felt bad if something had happened to me. I knew other people would be hurt by that, so I didn't want that to happen. So you don't, at that point, you really don't have a choice. I mean, there it is, take it or leave it. And it's like, well, I knew the option wasn't good to leave it, so I took it.
So that's interesting, the feeling of not wanting to get your heart taken out. I guess that makes a lot of sense. That's something you've lived with for many, many years. That's got to be kind of a trippy headspace to be in, where they're going to take out my heart and put in somebody else's.
It is. And the one thing that I really appreciated, too, or I appreciated many things, but the one thing the doctor said to me is, you know, don't be worried about this. It's all plug and play.
Huh.
It's like setting up an Xbox or something, you know. I mean, they're getting pretty good at it, and the techniques today are so much better than they were even a few years ago.
So they're just going to snip this and snip that and then sew them back together and crank it back up.
But what I understand is they actually remove my heart and hook it up to a machine that keeps it beating while they get the donor heart ready and put in your chest and then start hooking it up to everything.
Okay, so you come, that's crazy. You go through this this whole process, and you come out the other side, you wake up, and what's you feel something different. You have a new heart, and it's beating inside you, and what's that feeling like?
Well, I'll start with saying that they wheel you into a room with about 25 people yelling numbers at you. Not at you, but to each other.
Yeah.
And it's pretty intense. And the anesthesiologist came over and said, "This is overwhelming. I want to give you something to kind of take the edge off and help you relax." And I woke up 3 days later in my hospital room with my family around me.
Hmm.
So I think he's not the most honest man in the world. But,
just take the edge off.
But he did his job well. And I didn't even realize I'd had the surgery. So my sister, again, told me that the surgery was all over and that it was successful, and I reached down to see where the drive line came out of my belly, and it was gone, so I knew I didn't have that pump anymore, which was a wonderful feeling. And, you know, you're very weak, you're very tired, you have you on all kinds of medication, but it slowly starts to come back to you, and the next day they had me out of bed walking around my room.
They start the rehab process the next day.
Mm-hmm.
What was different? Could you tell a difference quickly with your health, your energy? How'd Jonathan's heart do?
Jonathan's heart is unbelievable. I go in for a weekly biopsy where they go in through my right side of my neck and go into the heart and take a biopsy and register all the pressures that the heart is going through, and the numbers are just perfect. They say it's a stunning recovery. Most people are still on oxycodone and using a walker, and I actually walked out of the hospital on my own to the garage. So I'm doing really well. One of the things that surprised me is I had trouble sleeping for the first few nights because I had not heard or felt a heartbeat as long as I could remember. And I could actually feel this heart beating and hear the pulse in my ears, and I was not used to that.
Wow. So you go without a heartbeat for quite some time, and I mean, do you ever just check, you were checking your wrist and feeling it, but you could feel the heart beating?
Oh, I can absolutely feel the heart beating now. And all my doctors are just so happy with it. Frankly, I'm honored to have Jonathan's heart. I wish it could have happened differently, but that it is what it is. But I say goodnight to Jonathan every night, and I say good morning to him every day.
Hmm. I saw some posts on Facebook after you had mentioned how well things were going, and you know, one of the things we always said about Jonathan is how good his heart was, and not speaking of it physically, but just his core and what he wanted to do in the world and how important organ donation was to him. And I think that would please him greatly to hear that that's going well.
It's going excellent. I'm having virtually zero rejection. They're cutting down on my medications every week when I go in. It couldn't be better. And I have to believe that some of that is because his heart was so good in every way.
Hmm. Okay, so you get up, you get better. I'd asked a question earlier about the energy levels. Are you feeling, you've obviously been in heart failure for quite some time. What's it like being able to go up a flight of steps or to walk a few, you know, around the hospital area and not get completely wiped out? Can you tell a big difference in the functionality there?
It's unbelievable, and it's more than walking around the hospital. I go shopping at department stores and outlet malls and everything else now, and I can walk like anybody else. Like, I have color again. I look at the before and after pictures, and I went from being just gray to having color in my face. I'm stronger every day. Your legs get a little bit weak being in the hospital for 2 months.
For sure.
But they've all come back, and I mean, I'm not winded. I don't get tired to where It was to a point where I couldn't even sit on the couch to watch TV. I'd just fall asleep and then wake up at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning because I was just always tired. And now I have all kinds of energy and do all kinds of things.
Well, you feel probably like you have a 31-year-old heart.
Yeah, I do. I do.
Yeah, that was it was a sad day for folks yesterday, but, you know, Jonathan's birthday, we all kind of contacted on Facebook and talked to each other and his mother, and I think this will be really good for them to hear this. It certainly is nice for me to be able to hear and talk to you and that you're doing so well. I think Jonathan would be pleased. All right, we are we're getting close to the midpoint of our show already. So I do want to ask you: do you have any more comments? We're going to spend the next the second half of the show really talking about the process after and contacting. Getting in touch with his family and that piece of it, because I know that's quite significant. But is there anything about the medical piece that you have left to share, or what the recovery's been like? You mentioned the rejection thing. I know that's really complicated a lot of times, but that sounds like that's going well. They're weaning you off the medications. Is there a point where you ever get off the rejection, the anti-rejection medications?
No, I take about 45 pills a day right now.
Wow.
But that, yeah, and that four times a day, but that's broken up over four times a day. So I really can't leave the house without my pill holder. But after 6 months, that will drop significantly. And after a year, it will drop almost completely. I'll still have to take a couple of the anti-rejection drugs daily, but that's not much of a sacrifice.
No, leaving home with your pillbox is probably better than leaving home with your battery, your extra batteries in your battery pack.
Yeah, or leaving home in an ambulance, which has happened more than once, so absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. I want to remind folks, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is heart transplant patient Bill Atkinson. And today we're talking to Bill really about his journey to finding a new heart and what that was like for him. You can call in with any questions or comments at 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can also email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with heart recipient Bill Atkinson. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into today's show, my guest is heart transplant patient Bill Atkinson, who received a new heart from Jonathan Gilbert on December 11th. Today, we're talking to Bill about his journey to finding a new heart. You can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Go ahead and get those calls in earlier before the last 10 minutes of the show, because that's when we'll be winding down. So please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. All right. We got a caller here on line one, and I'd go ahead and go to Lori. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to know, what exactly does this surgery cost, and how much does it cost you every day for all those pills you have to take?
Well, that's a good question. Between the operation to get the heart pump and the new heart, I think I'm going to be between $1.5 and $1.7 million.
Whew. Wow.
My copay for my drugs run about $1,000 a month, but that will go down considerably in 3 months and considerably more in 6 months.
Wow. Well, good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Lori. That's an interesting, that triggers a whole bunch of interesting questions about healthcare. And I guess if you don't have the resources, is that part of what gets you put on the transplant list, Bill? I hate to ask you that question.
No, that it really doesn't. They tell me that about 99% of people have to ask the university for financial assistance. And thank goodness there are trust funds and corporations that pay into that help cover the costs. And between the UW, University of Washington, accepting a lower payment, it's a pretty amazing thing that people will help complete strangers like that.
Okay, so there are some resources out there available, and if you're considering, or if you're on the transplant list, or have some failing health, that shouldn't be a consideration, is what you're saying.
You know, the financial services people as well as the doctors said you don't even need to think about that. We'll worry about that later. And they've been very good about it, and I just had to fill out about 2 pages of paperwork. And it's in the process right now, but they tell me it's kind of a no-brainer in my case. I mean, it's one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, procedure you can go through.
Well, it's sort of a no-brainer for most of us. I mean, that's that's the kind of money that, you know, we're lucky to make that in a lifetime. So that's good to hear that there's programs out there, and I appreciate you sharing that. Thanks for the question, Lori. So let's get back to the letter. Life Center Northwest reaches out to you, or is it a letter? Is it a email? How does Danita get in touch with you, and what does she say?
Well, Life Center Northwest has both of our contact information, and we can contact each other at any time, but she did it so quickly. I was still in the hospital, and they were actually hesitant to give me the letter because they thought it might be too soon for me to see that. And honestly, that was a huge encouragement to me, and it felt better just to know something about Jonathan and what an amazing life he had. And that gave me a lot of solace to know what he had accomplished in his way too short life. He wasn't just sitting around. He was out living, and that made me feel better.
Yeah, it is. Does it change things knowing, putting a face and a name and to this heart, make it more than just an organ? Or did you always kind of wonder that? Or I guess you didn't have much time, but were you thinking about that as a person or a life-saving sort of device?
I was thinking of it as a person on a very personal level, because I realized to live, somebody, you know, had to have a tragedy for them and their family. And you go through a stage. It's very much like the 7 stages you go through when somebody dies. And I felt happy for a while, then I felt guilty for a while, and I felt like after I read about Jonathan, how can I honor his memory and make sure that people know what he did? And I've actually contacted my U.S. senator, and there's several countries in Europe now that are, instead of opting in for a transplant donor, they opt out. So it's automatic when you get your driver's license that you're a donor unless you opt out of the program. And they've seen a significant increase because it's kind of tough. You know, you go in to get your driver's license and they hit you with that. And if you hadn't thought about it beforehand, it's pretty easy to mark no. But I hope we can get that change starting in the state of Washington and moving throughout the country.
That's sort of a project you're interested in and taking on?
Very much so. And if I can get it passed, it's going to be named somehow for Jonathan.
Wow. So I guess I take it the U.S. is a opt-in country.
Yes, it is at this point.
And I think you're right. I think people show up at the DMV and you're hassled because you got a ticket that says, you got to wait for 2.5 hours. And you get up there and they say, would you like to be an organ donor? And you're like, if you haven't done it.
I want out of here as soon as possible.
Right. You want out as soon as, I've been here way too long already. And I don't think people are educated necessarily about what that means to be an organ donor. At which point will they harvest your organs? Do you have to be brain dead? I mean, that's sort of like, I've heard even people say, will they let me die if my organ, if I'm an organ donor, will they not try as hard? And that is, I want to make it really clear that is not part of the program.
Absolutely not. So one of my talks with the social worker at the University of Washington was just about that. And she said, before organs are harvested, they're already gone. So it's a gift to them from after they die. And I don't know that makes it a lot easier, but it did for me.
Well, you said something interesting. You said somebody had to die for me to live, and one of the folks at Life Center Northwest said, no, it's she reframed it for me, and she said somebody died, and then you got the chance to live.
Right.
So that sort of is a shift in perspective because you didn't live because he died. It was he was going to die regardless, and the only thing that really let you live is that Jonathan took the time to check that box and say that he wanted to be an organ donor.
Exactly.
Has that shifted for you? I mean, I know you mentioned feeling struggling with guilt, and have you kind of been able to let that go or move through that?
Well, yeah, you have to move through it, and yes, it has started to shift for me. But I'll tell you that I don't think a day has gone by since I've been home that I haven't looked at his Facebook page and the pictures and the things he enjoyed doing, and I feel so bad for the family.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly can understand that, but I agree with you. At some point, it really wasn't. It's sort of like survivor's guilt, in war when your buddy gets killed, and why did I have to live? Must be sort of a similar feeling. So you get the letter from Danita, and then there's a process you go through Life Center Northwest. Did you bypass that? What was the decision like to make contact? How did you come to that?
Well, first of all, she sent me so much information and so early that I felt like she was trying to reach out to me. But I didn't want to make the mistake of just contacting her or Matthew, his younger brother. So I actually wrote to Matthew's wife on Facebook, and I said, you don't know me, but we have something in common, and if anybody ever wants to talk about it, I'm available anytime. And just within a few minutes, I got a reply back from Matthew, Jonathan's younger brother, saying, I don't think I know you. What's this about? And I said, well, it's very personal. And he wrote back and said, you have my brother's heart. Hmm. And I said, yes. And I said, if you ever want to meet and talk, it would be my honor. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow?
Huh.
So he was anxious too.
Yeah, I know he was very anxious. I've talked to Matt about that. And so can you describe, you didn't have much time to prepare for that. That happened pretty quick.
Yes, it did. And I couldn't be happier that I met him. And I'll tell you that the honest to goodness truth. When we met, there was a connection that I haven't had with very many people in my life, and I consider him family, and he had said the same thing. It was nice to see that my brother's heart had done something for somebody else, and he only lives about an hour from me, and I think we're going to be friends for a long, long time. At least that's my hope, and he's agreed too.
It's a connection that probably can't really describe, huh? I mean, there's a depth to it, almost a spirituality, it seems like.
No, there's not too many people I meet coming off an elevator, not too many men anyway, that I walk up to and give a hug, and they give a hug back. But it was pretty amazing. And it was hard for him, too, even though he wanted to meet so soon. I know it was hard for him because it brings back, you know, memories and thoughts and everything else, but we'll get by that.
Yeah. Have you spoken to anybody else in his family? I know Danita's hasn't yet spoken to you, as far as I know. I've talked to her, and she's very, very happy, and wanted me to tell you that Jonathan's heart seems like he's gone to a good person. Have you spoken to anybody else in his family?
Well, I've spoken to Matthew's wife, and they have a brand new baby that's just a beautiful little girl. And I have got a message from Matthew that his father wants to meet me, so we're trying to set that up so I can meet him soon. And his mother's just not ready yet. And I said, you know, I'm not here to make anybody uncomfortable. If it takes her 5 years, it takes her 5 years to be comfortable. That's
right.
The most important thing to me is that she's okay with it when we do meet. But I'll be happy to meet with her anytime she's ready.
Yeah, I think it's just so cool that you have his heart and that I'm sitting here talking to you. And, you know, I remember it was that night. I'll just tell a quick story about that you haven't heard about that day in the transplant. We had gone in and I was saying goodbye to Jonathan, and I was, you know, holding his hand and, talking to him. And I was one of the last people in there with his mom. And I said goodbye, and I kissed him on the forehead, and I turned and I walked out. And as I opened the door, there's this team of transplant surgeons. They're all dressed in blue and they're standing. There's like 10 of them. And I'm not sure how accurately I remember this, but there was one like silver haired gentleman in the middle. And he looked, you know, the first thing that popped into my head was like, this is God. And I looked at him and I gave him two thumbs up, and he looked at me and said, "We're going to take good care of your boy, sir." And I just walked out, and I was absolutely stunned. I was like, I had goosebumps, and I still have them right now telling that story. But that was the last time I saw Jonathan before they took him off to do that. It was a powerful moment. And I wanted you to hear that story as well.
Well, it's unimaginable to me what friends and family went through. I just hate to think of that.
And then another part of that story is we all gather together, and this is a interesting part of the story. It doesn't have quite the same emotionality to it, but we go and have Mexican food, and we're all, you know, we had been at the hospital for a while, and we're all sitting around at a Mexican restaurant. There's probably 12 of us, and we're telling stories about JJ and his life and this whole process, and, you know, laughing and crying and doing all that stuff. And then my cell phone buzzes, and I look down, and I don't even remember what time it was, but it said, "Just wanted to let you know that Jonathan's organs have been successfully transplanted." And it was, I was like, we just left the hospital. How is that possible? Wow. And they put in a new heart. Like, I just had a burrito. And it was pretty amazing to get that. And so I stopped and I said to everybody, Jonathan's organs have been placed in 4 people. And everybody just kind of got quiet and we're like, wow.
You know, it's amazing. What a gift he gave.
Yeah, because the heart can only last about 3 or 4 hours outside the body, is my understanding.
Right. So they had to move quickly because it came coming from Anchorage. It's about as far to Seattle as they can transport a heart.
Yeah, they can't go much farther.
No.
All right. So what are the challenges that you now have with your new heart? Like, what are you going through? You mentioned a little bit about the medication stuff. Is there anything else going on that is of concern? Or you've, like, what's life like now?
Life is great now, and I think I appreciate it now more than ever. There's a few things that are kind of hard to get used to. I can't eat at a buffet. I can't have raw vegetables for a year. I can't work in my yard because of any bacteria, anything that gets on you can affect your rejection because the drugs basically shut down your immune system, so your own immune system doesn't attack its new heart. But those are all hardly worth noting. I mean, it's waking up in the morning and not sitting on the edge of your bed for an hour because it is so exhausting to put on your socks. I think I can do without raw vegetables for a year.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So you really have to be cautious of infection or any kind of virus or illness because you're very susceptible to that right now.
Yes, and it's interesting to me that the University of Washington actually makes you sign a contract saying you are willing to do these things in honor of the donor.
Wow, okay. So they're very much, one of my experiences with Life Center Northwest is they're very, very, they honor the process very much, and they really do. I mean, they have a flag-raising ceremony at the hospital for his family where they fly a flag in honor of him for 5 days. They have the wall of honor where we still haven't gotten Jonathan's story and picture there that I know of, but they really do honor that gift, and it sounds like the University of Washington supports that as well and sort of makes that their mission as well.
Yes, they do, and I'm glad they do.
Yeah. So what's next for you as far as your life and your future? I mean, what do you got plans? You going anywhere? I mean, I know it sounds like you're down for about a year, but you got a new bucket list, or you said you appreciate life more. You came about as close to death as you could without actually dying. What's next for you in your life?
Well, there's been a pretty big attitude change. I've collected a lot of things and been very fussy about my cars and very fussy about a lot of things that, you know, a door ding is just not nearly as important to me now as it was. And people, your friends and your family are far more important. And I have kind of vowed that I'm going to do more things instead of buying more things at the end of this year. So I hope I can do that with friends and family and people I meet along the way. I hope I can do some volunteer work. I had a couple of different heart recipients come in and talk to me when I was in the hospital. So I'd like to do something like that, and I'd like to work on that project to get an opt-out rather than an opt-in for organ donation. So those are the kind of things that I look forward to in a year.
What did the recipients have to say, the people who had gone before you? And why was that important?
You know, I think it's just reinforcement. They're telling you that things will be okay. They've had the operation by the same doctors, the same teams. And, you know, they have them walk in and talk to you, and they're just very positive people. And it's pretty amazing. I had one gentleman come in that was 30 years old that was put on 1A. And he said he went down with his family to have lunch in the cafeteria, and he got a call saying, "Are you still here? We have a heart for you." So he didn't even leave the hospital. But honestly, you would never, ever recognize me now as anybody that had ever been sick before. And I had people tell me before I look like warmed over death. So I'm feeling pretty positive about the future.
Yeah, you were really, really close.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you tell anybody who's going through this process or of waiting for a transplant of any kind? I mean, I've known people that have been through this and their struggles and talk to them. You know, I've worked with a couple of people who've been on the transplant list. And what's your advice to anybody who might be entering this process or going through it or struggling as they're waiting?
That it's absolutely worth it. I mean, I do not even take Tylenol for pain. I just have had an amazing recovery. I think my life is going to be as normal as it was or much better than it was beforehand, and that it's worth doing. I was told, and I felt really bad, that there was like a 28-year-old man down the hall from me when I was in the transplant ward that was refusing a heart. And he didn't want to go through it. And it's, you know, it seems like forever when you're there, but now I can just blink my eyes and can't believe how fast and far I've come in such a short period of time.
Yeah, it really is a remarkable story. And it's really good to get this other side, the other perspective, because much of our conversation last time was really from the donor perspective. This is my first foray into organ donation at any level. And now I've gotten to kind of see it from both sides. What are your, is there anything you want to say to Jonathan's family or thoughts you have about Jonathan and his life and what it means to you?
You know, that's really hard to put in words. It means everything to me, but I still feel so bad that they have had to go through what they've gone through. And to me, that's unimaginable. And it would just be wrong to say, I understand, or, you know, I see how you feel, because I don't know that I ever could, not having kids of my own. But, you know, I've said it before to people that the greatest gift I've ever received, I never saw. And the person that gave it to me, I never knew.
If we didn't have more time, that would be a great thing to end on. But that's amazing. You never really get to see the organ, and you never will. You never get to see his heart, but you get to feel it every single day.
Right.
Is there anything that you want to know about Jonathan? Anything?
Well, he just seems like an amazing individual. In talking to his brother and reading the obituary and the things that he accomplished, my brother-in-law said, there's no way he did all this by 30, and he did. So, you know, I've told you before, that makes me feel good to know that at least he was alive and not, you know, the kind of guy that just sat around, that he was out there doing things that he enjoyed doing and helping people. It's a pretty amazing legacy that he's left behind.
Yeah, I will say to your you said your brother-in-law,
mm-hmm.
That Jonathan did all of those things.
I know that.
He did them quickly, and he tended to go through things, and he was very much looking for his fit and his place in this world. And I know he was a father, and he was a soldier, and he took those things very seriously. And he was searching, and it seemed like he was just chewing up life. Like, he just went through stuff and had a lot of experiences. So that heart that you have has been a lot of places and done a lot of things and has a lot of people who love it.
Well, I'll never forget Jonathan and what he's done. And, you know, the doctors have all said, you've got one heck of a heart there. It's just booming away like it should. So I'm thankful to him every day. And there hasn't been a day since, and I hope there never is a day that I haven't stopped and thought about him.
Yeah, that's really nice. I think it'll be good. I contacted the Life Center Northwest folks and told them that we were going to be doing this show, and they're really looking forward to listening to it. Have you had any more contact with them? Because I called Sonia Kreselik, I think is her name, from Life Center Northwest right before we went on the air, and And she said, oh my goodness, he's talked to them already. And she was very much looking forward to it and wanted me to say hello to you. I know she doesn't know you, but have you had any more contact with the folks from Life Center Northwest after this?
Or? No, I have not.
You probably...
And probably don't need to at this point, but what a wonderful service they provide, too.
Anything, can you just kind of speak briefly? We're just about out of time here. Can you speak briefly to organ donation in general, and if people are kind of on the fence, about it, what would you say to them if they're wondering if they should be an organ donor?
Well, I've thought about that a lot, and I went for years without being an organ donor, and I'm happy to say that now I can actually qualify and be an organ donor myself. So as soon as I get down below the town of Skykomish, population 198, I'm going to go into the DMV and make sure that they change my status to an organ donor. Because now my kidneys are functioning, my heart is functioning, and those could all be used again if something happens to me. But I would tell people learn the facts. You have to make your own decision. You can't be pressured into it from somebody else, but learn the facts. See where you have to be before you qualify to donate your organs, and understand that you're giving a gift that is just amazing.
Yeah, one of the things that that I've heard, and I did a lot of research on organ donation for the first program, and much of the talk on the internet, you can find anything, but anything to support whatever you want to find. But one of the things, there's a lot of misunderstandings about what it takes, and it really is brain death has to be established, and before that, there's never even a conversation about organ donation. There's not, they don't approach you, they don't pressure you, doctors aren't getting any kickback, so there's nothing going on that is untoward. It's just a gift, and I understand that the number is about 80% of people, so I appreciate you joining the ranks there, Bill, and I really do. I do thank you for taking the time to join us today. I appreciate it.
It was my honor.
All right. My thanks to today's guest, Bill Atkinson. It was great to have you let us kind of share in your journey. If you'd like to continue today's conversation, you can join us on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, and that's at alaskapublic.org. While the recommendations for cancer screening and options for treatment are evolving rapidly, learn more about the latest on prostate cancer screening and treatment with Dr. Thad Woodard on the next Line One, Your Health Connection. That's Monday, January 30th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. Eric Bork is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line One. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.